This episode of Tales from Ostlantis is brought to you by Ostlantis Premium. Don't you just hate having your favorite podcast interrupted by ads like this? Well, dear listener, you're in luck. Because starting at just $3 a month, you can support independent Chicano media and receive ad-free episodes, premium episodes, bonus content, and access to our Discord server. Just visit talesfromostlantis.com and click Go Premium, or follow the link in the show notes. And now, on with the show.
You must excuse me. I've grown quite weary.
This hasn't been easy, I know. But you've learned a lesson. A lesson in honesty. Honesty to yourself and honesty to others. That lesson will stand you in good stead all your life.
I think we've all learned a good lesson. I've always heard that honesty is the best policy. Now I'm catching on to why that's so,
Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to yet another episode of Tales from Ostlantis. We are your hosts, Curly Tlapoyawa.
And Ruben Ariano Tlacatecat.
What's going on, man? How are you?
Trying to beat the heat over here.
Yeah, no joke. It's been a scorcher over here, and apparently New Mexico is heading for another heat wave, so.
Texas is under what they're calling a heat dome, and it's not, most of Texas is.
It sounds horrifying.
it's pretty hot. In Dallas, we've lucked out a little bit. We're supposed to be having like triple digit temperatures, and it feels hot, but we've had some storms come through, and they cool things off during the day for a little bit, and then it warms back up in the afternoon, and it's a roller coaster ride over there with us.
Well, Tlaloc provides, so make sure you leave some offerings out.
To bring
some of that precious rain. Yeah,
good to make heat dome offerings.
Yeah. We need to get back to that. Heat Dome, that sounds like the name of a Stephen King book.
And the heat is on.
Under the heat dome. Yeah. Well, I remember how hot it used to get out there. I remember the first year that Michelle and I moved out there. The dashboard of Michelle's car melted. So that was pretty wild.
Wow. Yeah.
There were crickets everywhere, or grasshoppers. I can't remember. But do you remember that?
Yeah.
It was like this mass infestation everywhere. Right.
And people were talking about the biblical times and the plague, and it's the end of the world, the new millennium, and all this stuff. I'm like, oh, my God.
Oh, and Texas.
And here we are, 2023.
So today's topic, and it's an interesting one because we've been wanting to do this one for a while. Dr. Ott. Also known as, what was his real name? I've only ever known him as Dr. Ott.
His full name was Jose Murillo.
Murillo, right?
Yeah, Murillo.
Gerardo Murillo.
Ándale, Jose Gerardo Murillo. Yeah. No, Jose Gerardo Francisco Murillo.
There it is. Dr. Ott, el doctor. So for the sake of this episode, we're just going to call him Dr. Ott, which means Dr. Water. Which is interesting. Speaking of water.
Right. How appropriate.
How apropos for this episode. And it's funny because I first came across the name Dr. Ott in like 1993 or 94. And it was in one of the Mexica movement booklets.
Really?
Yeah. It was under a list of like the great Mexican heroes or something. And Dr. Ott was listed there, and it only had like a sentence. It had his name, and it was like he was a great, Mexican painter who elevated indigenous people through his artwork and blah, blah, blah. And then that was it.
Okay.
That's all it said about him. So as we'll see in this episode, it's a lot more nuanced. And, it's a little more complicated than just that. But that's the first time I'd heard about him. And
so there's more going on, more than meets the eye, huh?
More than meets the water.
the water.
So strap yourselves in, dear listeners, as we explore the history and legacy of Dr. Ott.
To tell the story of Dr. Ott right, we must go back to the mid-19th century, to a time when Mexico was still trying to define itself as a nation. The aftermath of the War for Mexican Independence in 1821 had produced a need for a unified national consciousness. And while the line between so-called mestizos and criollos had been blurred by then, there still existed entrenched social, cultural, and ideological differences among the masses. Both mestizos and criollos considered themselves members of a single Mexican nation, which also had a significant population of pueblos originarios, or indigenous peoples. In theory, the Constitution of 1824 had established a common citizenship between all of them, and in the newly founded Estados Unidos Mexicanos, or the United States of Mexico, there were to be no citizenship distinctions. But however, these democratic ideas did not prevent the rise of regionalism among rural indigenous communities who still viewed themselves in localized communal terms and regional identities. These distinctions contributed to the rift that existed between the urban metropoles and the rural provinces. Among the many changes that were supposed to be brought on by the Mexican independence, one of them was the unification of the country under a common national culture. The intention was to bridge the gap between the two distinct social-cultural Mexicos, which were urban, wealthy, and mixed white, versus the rural, poor, and indigenous peasant. This idea was nicely articulated by the Mexican anthropologist Guillermo Bonfil Batalla in his highly influential book, El México Profundo, Una Civilización Negada, or in English, México Profundo, Reclaiming a Civilization. In it, he noted that there exist two Mexicos. One is imaginary or synthetic, and the other is profundo or deeply rooted. The former is one created by criollo mestizo elites in their emulation of Western European and Anglo-American society, and the latter is one that is deeply rooted in Mesoamerican indigenous thought and culture. Batalla admonished the consumerism and capitalism that had sullied the primordial character of Mexico and advocated in favor of restoring control to Mexico Profundo. Arguably, the imaginary Mexico started during the Spanish invasion and colonization in the 16th century. But bringing it back to our current topic, we can point to the death of Benito Juárez as a significant watershed moment in the course of Mexican history. Juárez was an idealist who favored a liberal, democratic form of government like that of the United States of America. After his death, the democratic experiment he had envisioned for his beloved country began its slow regression into autocratic despotism. In 1877, General Porfirio Díaz assumed the presidency for the first time, although he had effectively controlled the government since his coup d'etat the year before. In addition to being a well-seasoned veteran of multiple wars, such as the Guerra de Reforma in 1857, the French intervention of 1862, and other military engagements, Díaz was also a cunning politician who managed to stay in power for 3.5 decades. This turbulent and highly stratified period of Mexican history is known as the Porfiriato. Díaz's dictatorship provided a stabilized government by suppressing civil unrest while championing the economic success of capitalist investors and the landed elite. Conversely, the Porfirian regime encouraged the excesses of the wealthy and the profiteering by foreign investors, i.e. Anglo-Americans, British, German, and others, at the expense of the working poor who suffered immensely under this regime. To put things into perspective, the situation in Mexico was so bad that it would be as if a more severe form of the Great Depression had lasted for 30 years and only in the United States. The dire situation produced by Diaz's exploitative government was one of the major factors which contributed to the revolt in 1910. But it was his assumption of the presidency for an eighth term while refusing to accept Francisco I. Madero's challenge in an open democratic election that sparked the call to arms. That was the final straw for Mexicans of all stripes. Indigenous artists.
And an interesting side note about Diaz was that he was, I believe he was Zapoteca, and he would powder his face white to like mask his indigenous features. So that's it's sad. It's like the perfect, I don't know, expression of the colonialism, right? That Native Mexicans faced. There's just this shame that was put on them. And, you know, I mean, he wasn't a great guy, obviously, but it was interesting that he would hide his indigenous features go to that extent, because if you look at photos of him when he was a young man, he's very dark. And then if you look at photos of him later, it's obvious that he's like masking his indigeneity.
Yep.
So, and also for any listeners out there who have not read Mexico Profundo, I encourage them to do so, because it's a really good book.
It's a very, very resourceful, foundational, and useful book for scholars and even just people interested in Mexican indigeneity and this idea of there existing sort of two broad cultures, one that's sort of in control and it's Eurocentric, and one that is at the bottom of the ranks and more in tune with its indigenous roots.
Yep.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Have you picked up your Mexica calendar for the year 12 Flint? Or how about a paperback copy of The Four Disagreements? Just visit talesfromastlantis.com for all the latest merchandise and show some love for your favorite podcast. That's talesfromastlantis.com for all the latest merchandise. Now, back to the show. So continuing, amid this political turmoil and civil unrest, we find that modern indigenous artists had already started molding and creating the nationalist tropes that would help define the country's identity in the 20th century. One of these artists was Gerardo Murillo, who was better known by his artistic name, Dr. Atl, which is Nahuatl for water. Dr. Atl was a creative storyteller, and his recollections surrounding the origin of his Nahuatl name is emblematic of that talent. In an interview he gave to the famed Mexican journalist Jacobo Zubladowski, the following is what he says about how he got his name.
And I think it's Zabludowski.
Zabludowski? Yeah. What did I say?
Zubludowski.
Oh,
I can't. Close enough. Quote, I made a trip many years ago from New York to Paris, and on the ship I suffered a terrible storm. The ship almost sank, which would have given me much pleasure. Even the captain became seasick. So much water, man, and here I am with his name. I'm going to name myself Water in some language. It seemed to me that there were none beautiful enough for me to have. Water in French, in Spanish too. I'm giving to myself.
That's how you say water in French.
I'm going to name myself Water in Nahuatl. I named myself Atl. I arrived in Paris, and with that name, I signed my canvases, my commitments, etc. I like how he's just like, etc.
Yeah, etc. Like, who says etc. in an actual sentence?
This guy.
Apparently, this soul-searching trip occurred in 1896, the same year that Atl's distaste for the pervasive Spanish influence in Mexican culture started to manifest itself. But his naming adventure did not end there. In that same interview with Zabludovsky, did I get it right that time?
I think so, yeah.
Ott stated that sometime in the early 19-teens, during another stay in Paris, his friend, the Argentine poet Leopoldo Lugones, commented on the simplicity of Ott's name and suggested that he add a title to it.
That of only Ott is unappealing. Why don't you add a title to it? To which I said, title of prince? King? Of what? No, a title. Ah, well, I'm a doctor in philosophy. Dr. Ott! Then the next day, we called our friends, who were many, and in his apartment, which was very nice, they filled a tub with champagne, undressed me, and put me in the tub. And they said to me, you are Dr. Ott. And since then, I am Dr. Ott. You know, it just occurred to me, now that you're a doctor, Dr. Curley,
yes.
we need to follow this formula. We need to undress you, put you in a tub full of champagne, and baptize you, Dr. Curley.
Absolutely.
Right on.
Live stream it. I am now Dr. Curley.
Dr. Curley.
With his, well, but can we use like pulque instead of champagne? Or does it have to be champagne?
No, it can be pulque. Pulque sounds good. Yeah.
I'm down.
Absolutely.
With his mock baptism, Dr. Ott inadvertently initiated a naming tradition that continues to be practiced to this day among Neo-Aztecas. He was so enamored with the idea of Nahuatl names that he renamed Carmen Mondragon, his lover and also the object of his artistic expression, to Nahui Olin, or Four Movement, the Aztec sign which represents one of the previous ages of humanity, as well as the four basic elements of life, the four seasons and other metaphorical concepts. While not as well known as his contemporaries, Dr. Ott is famous for his landscape paintings of Mexico's volcanoes, and according to the great Mexican muralist José Clemente Orozco, Ott was the father of Mexican muralism. And just a little admission here, not a fan of his landscapes.
Really?
I'm just going to put that out there. Yeah, wow. I never liked his landscapes. Huh. But, you know, eye of the beholder and all that.
Exactly.
José Gerardo Francisco Murillo, Dr. Ott, was born in 1875 in Guadalajara, Jalisco. He came from a comfortable urban middle-class background, and the relative wealth of his family afforded him the privilege of attending the Liceo de Varones de Guadalajara, one of the largest institutions of education in Jalisco at the time. Showing interest in the arts from an early age, Dr. Ott made his way to Le Havre, France? 1897. I even said it like a question. France? And stayed with Baron Gostkowski. That sounds like a pro wrestler.
Right.
Baron Gostkowski, a cosmopolitan aristocrat of Franco-Slavic descent, who spent many years in Mexico, even becoming a citizen, where he was known for his satirical writings. During his years in Europe, between attending classes in Rome and showing his work at the Paris Salon, Ott became radically politicized and well-versed in Marxist and anarchic literature, particularly with the writings of George Sorel and various Italian ideologues. The ideas he was exposed to in Europe led to his political involvement in the Mexican Revolution. As a close friend of President Venustiano Carranza, Ott went on to serve as the Minister of Public Education, where he was able to leverage his position through politics, academia, and the arts world. His political influence translated into a message that resonated with young and energetic artists, some of whom went on to become Mexico's most renowned. Dr. Ott graduated with a doctorate in philosophy in 1900, so he was a doctor.
Yeah, doctor.
And after a few years, returned to Mexico. In 1904, he joined the Escuela Nacional de Bellas Artes, ENBA or ENBA, is that... ENBA?
I think so.
Where he taught paintings and explored early ideas of mural work he had acquired in Europe during his many visits to places like the Sistine Chapel. In his autobiography, Orozco recalls that Dr. Atl would visit his night class and recount his European exploits to the students while they worked. He enthusiastically described the Sistine Chapel and Da Vinci, and how the great techniques of the ancients, the great murals, the Renaissance, and the Egyptian pyramids had been lost for 400 years. That same year of 1904, Dr. Atl was part of a group of revolutionary painters in San Pedro de Tlaquepaque, a neighborhood in the city of Guadalajara, where he organized an exhibition of his paintings. Other exhibitions included conferences which advanced a clear revolutionary orientation, and it is here where Atl initiated the Mexican Pictorial Revolution. Not long thereafter, in 1906, he conducted a painting exhibition put on by the magazine Savia Moderna, a publication of the Ateneo de la Juventud, or how the hell do you say that?
I think it's Athenaeum of Youth.
Athenaeum of Youth, which was comprised of young intellectuals disconnected with the direction of Mexico's artistic and intellectual life. Most members of the Ateneo de la Juventud were under 30 years of age and included Diego Rivera, José Vasconcelos, Antonio Caso, and Atl himself. Holy shit.
Right.
According to Margarita Vera Cuspinera's entry in the Encyclopedia of Mexico, History, Society, and Culture, the purpose of the Ateneo was
to formulate an alternative to the medieval rigidity, positivist orthodoxy, and Francophile affectation which had defined Mexican intellectual life. The very name of the group, the Youth Athenaeum, established a counterpoint to the gerontocracy of Porfirio Diaz. Ouch.
Burn. This exhibition was perhaps the first time the Mexican painters had the opportunity to present their native talent to the public. The following year, 1907, Dr. Atl arranged Diego Rivera's first exhibition to help him raise funds to study and travel in Europe. Things were moving fast, and by 1908, Atl painted his first large-scale mural at the Academy of San Carlos. That mural was the first of its kind by a modern Mexican artist, and it foreshadowed the muralist movement that rose to prominence after the revolution. Administrative officials at San Carlos took issue with the mural's folkloric theme because it broke with the convention of emulating European high art. Atl had grown tired of mimicking Europe and felt that Mexican artists should look inward for expressions of national art. Despite his displeasure at the destruction of his work and ongoing disagreement with the administration, he continued painting and teaching at the academy. Between the years 1906 and 1910, he oversaw the inventory of old paintings that belonged to the academy, many of which he considered destroying because they reflected the old Eurocentric paradigm.
This guy.
His big break came in 1910 when he gathered enough money to help Mexican artists who wanted to present their own version of indigenous art to celebrate the first centenary of Mexican independence. The exhibition was a success, and Atl proposed organizing the new school of artists into a society called Centro Artístico, whose purpose was to get the government to provide walls in public buildings for the young artists to paint. Unfortunately, the socio-political revolution broke just as the artistic revolution of the group was underway, leaving them no choice but to abandon their projects. Mexico's avant-garde artists had to wait more than a decade before their vision was appreciated, at which point the post-revolutionary project of nation-building coincided with the acceptance of folk and indigenous arts and the rise of monumental mural paintings. Each artistic vogue has its iconic representatives, and for Mexican muralism, Orozco, Rivera, and Siqueiros automatically come to mind, and justifiably so. They constitute the leaders of the post-revolutionary vanguard of artists who are rightfully called the masters of Mexican muralism. And if you've ever stood in front of any of their murals in real life, it's like, holy shit, man.
Right.
It's, you don't even... Man. you can't capture that in a photo. Like when you see their murals in a book,
yeah,
as opposed to standing in front of
exactly.
one.
Exactly.
It's mind blowing.
It's a whole different, I mean, it's a whole different experience altogether. You have Absolutely. To see them in person.
Yeah. Dr. Ott deserved his due in that history as well. While it is universally accepted that Orozco and Rivera epitomize the nationalistic aesthetic of the era, they also represent the maximum evolution of Mexican muralism, a medium pioneered by Dr. Ott. His influence cannot be overstated, and to a certain degree, Orozco and Rivera owe their success to him. Orozco was a student of Ott's in the years preceding the revolution, and Rivera's first trip to Europe in 1906 was made possible due to Ott's assistance in selling his artwork to raise funds for his passage. Ott even wrote Rivera a letter of introduction to his friend and fellow artist Eduardo Chicharro, who became Rivera's teacher during his stay in Spain. An internationally renowned painter, Ott had clout in the art world and beyond. But more importantly, Orozco's statement that Ott was the father of Mexican muralism is incontrovertible. The possibility that without him, Mexican muralism might never have existed makes Ott's influence even more substantial. Despite Ott's visionary foresight and rejection of traditional convention, one wonders why he did not continue working in that medium. Art historian Olga Saenz asked that same question and arrived at the answer given by Dr. Ott himself.
In his written account, Ott narrates with some nostalgia that his large format works were destroyed. He refers to the frescoes painted in 1901 in the Villa on Via Flaminia 14, Rome. In 1908, Murillo painted a large frieze with female figures like nymphs or muses carrying a wreath towards a portrait of Alejandro Luis Olavatierra, who had donated a valuable collection of paintings to the Academy. Doña Carmen Romero Rubio de Díaz, wife of Porfirio Díaz, ordered its removal because it portrayed the nymphs nude. Oh, oh my God.
So they were always that way.
Yeah.
Like these people were always that way. Offended by the cancel culture.
Right. Clutch my pearls.
Yeah, clenching their pearls at the sight of a nude fictional character. In addition to the destruction of the work mentioned above, administration officials at the San Pedro y San Pablo Academy ordered the demolition of many of Ott's murals that decorated the Academy's patio in 1921. First, Vasconcelos had the nymphs on the murals altered when he remodeled the Academy to open the Hall of Discussion, which housed an office that operated his campaign against illiteracy. Minister Narciso Bassols later had them completely destroyed. These incidents soured Ott to the idea of large-scale murals, and he opted instead for the easel and the canvas. Nonetheless, Dr. Ott's affinity for indigenous art and culture and his innovation in muralism launched an artistic movement in Mexico during the post-revolutionary era. In Ott's work, the tension between the Hispanic and indigenous traditions came to a head. Even before the master muralists ever considered adopting folk-style art and indigenous tropes, Ott had already experimented with those ideas as far back as the late 1800s. Few academically trained artists were doing it then. Ott's contribution to neo-folk art and romanticized indigenism helps describe the general sentiment at the time. The liberal mestizo Eurocentrism that dominated social and cultural life during the latter half of the 19th century was beginning to crack by the end of the century, and young dreamers like Ott, who were tired of that paradigm, were there to exploit the rupture that would soon tear the country apart. Typical of rebellious youth, these dreamers rejected the culture of their elders and opted instead to create one of their own. This new culture was not only oppositional, but it was also one that celebrated the local folkloric traditions of the homeland. It is in this transitional and experimental period that a new indigenous narrative emerged and gave rise to Neo-Mexica groups during the cultural revival and ethnicization or Indianization of Mexican nationhood. The term ethnicization is used by the historian Rick A. Lopez in his book, Crafting Mexico, Intellectuals, Artisans, and the State After the Revolution, published in 2010. In his discussion of the term, he notes, I saw Moises coming up, so I mixed notes and Moises because I read with the idea of making things super simple. He notes that Moises Sáenz, the leading educational advocate and reformer of education in Mexico during the first half of the 20th century, described this post-revolutionary movement as the Indianization of Mexico's nationality. Other scholars have called it the Browning of the Nation. I think that's what the MAGA Trumpers call right. Mexicans moving into the United States, too.
It's weird to call what was going on in Mexico the Browning of the Nation when the nation is mostly brown.
Yeah, like the nation's like 99% brown. So
like, you know, I think Indianization is more appropriate. Browning of the Nation is a little too... I think that's something that maybe white Mexicans would say.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Those without a doubt.
Elitist academic... light-skinned Mexicans who look down on everybody else would probably say
it's
that.
They're browning the nation. The term ethnicization attempted to capture the fluidity and contested nature of this embrace of indigenousness as part of the national identity. Even as the Asian and Black presence was being erased and prejudice against indigenous people was continually being reframed, it's in this socio-political landscape that romantic indigenism in the shape of Neo-Aztecism began to emerge in Mexico City. It was obvious that the Indianization of Mexico would be Aztec. And of course, their history would be idealized, sensationalized, and fictionalized. With the fall of Diaz and his Anglo-Eurocentric reign of power, the post-revolutionary era, with all its hopes and dreams, was ripe for a cultural transformation and historical confabulation. That's a good word.
Yeah.
Confabulation. Atlantis and Mesoamerica.
Dr. Ott was an educated and cultured man, and like any person of his stature, he would have been well-read in the classics and the academic literature at the time. It is no wonder that he was fascinated by the legend of Atlantis. Ott believed that Atlantis had once existed in the Atlantic Ocean, and he dedicated much of his life to studying and writing about it. Ott's ideas about Atlantis were based on the writings of Plato, the Maya codices, and his own personal research, deducing that Atlantis had been a highly advanced civilization that was destroyed by a cataclysmic flood.
I wonder if he had also read Le Plongeon.
You know, I wouldn't doubt if he. I mean, I think that's one of the works that was highly influential. So yeah, I wouldn't doubt that he had read it. I think, yeah. Because there was another scholar that we need to talk about at some point, Eustaquio Buelna, who was writing things also in the late 19th century that was based on a lot of the stuff that I'm not sure if he took. I think he cites Le Plongeon, so I'm curious to see how much of it was his own original research as a Mexican scholar working in Mexico, as opposed to Le Plongeon, who was a foreigner working in Mexico or Central America. So I think he was definitely reading Eustaquio. He was probably reading Le Plongeon as well. So yeah.
Yeah, fascinating.
Fascinating. Where was I? He also believed that the survivors of Atlantis migrated to other parts of the world, including Mexico, where their culture and knowledge influenced the development of Mesoamerican civilizations. A prolific writer and speaker, Dr. Ott wrote articles and lectured on politics, the arts, but also on Atlantis, all over the world. He published widely on the topic, including a book on the fable entitled Un Grito en la Atlántida, or in English, A Cry for Atlantis, published in 1947. The following are some of Ott's ideas about Atlantis.
1. He thought it was a large island located in the Atlantic Ocean near the Azores. 2. It was a highly advanced civilization that was destroyed by a cataclysmic flood. 3. The survivors migrated to other parts of the world, including Mexico, where their culture and knowledge influenced the development of Mesoamerican civilization. I wonder if Graham Hancock was reading Dr. Ott at some point.
Ding, ding, ding.
And 4, it was a symbol of a lost golden age of humanity, and that its rediscovery would usher in a new era of peace and prosperity.
I come in peace. It's funny how a lot of these ideas are like basically what New Age philosophy is based on, right? So it wouldn't surprise me if Ott was also influenced by a lot of theosophical writings as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. You know? I'm sure there's some, what was her name?
Helena Blavatsky.
Helena Blavatsky was somewhere on the bookshelf.
She's looming large over all this.
Mm-hmm.
In previous episodes, we have discussed the fascination that some early and foundational leaders of Mexicayot had with Atlantis and its supposed connection with Aztlan and Mesoamerica in general.
Hence the name of our podcast.
What? While our research is ongoing, Dr. Ott appears to be the earliest figure that we've found who is associated with Neo-Aztecism and who advanced the erroneous connection between Aztlan and Atlantis. This is an interesting point here because Juan Luna Cárdenas, who we consider the godfather of Mexicayot or the Mexicayot movement, and his group of followers were becoming active in the 1920s as the muralist movement was underway. So it is almost certain that Dr. Ott and Luna Cárdenas crossed paths at some point. As previously noted, Ott not only gave Diego Rivera his start, but he was also associated with Guillermo Caló, Frida Kahlo's father, who was a famous photographer in his own right. Ott and Guillermo collaborated and co-published a book together entitled A Photographic Inventory of Spanish Colonial Church Architecture in Mexico. And this was in 1910, even before Diego Rivera got his start.
Yeah, I never knew that.
So, what's more, Diego and Frida were also close friends with Eulalia Guzman, the Mexican archaeologist credited with helping identify the supposed bones of Cuauhtémoc, the last Mexica Tlatoani, in the town of Ixcatiopan, Guerrero. Guzman was a key member of the Movimiento Confederado Restaurador de la Cultura de Anáhuac, or the MCRCA, which we've talked about at length here on this podcast. Go back and listen to those episodes, especially season one. The organization, which is the most responsible for spreading pseudo-archaeology and pseudo-history of the Aztecs and the Maya through their neo-indigenous ideology that we call Mexicayot. But lest we give the wrong impression of Dr. Ott, we should also note that he is known in Mexican history not only for his art, but also because he was a prominent figure in the Mexican Revolution, as we noted earlier. Ott was a complex and fascinating figure. He was a painter, a writer, a revolutionary, and a theorist. He was a passionate advocate for the preservation of Mexico's natural beauty, which can be seen through his art, and his work continues to inspire people in Mexico and around the world. I want to say maybe 5 or 6 years ago, the Dallas Museum of Art did a show, and I don't remember if it was... I don't think they focused specifically on Dr. Ott's work, but his work was prominently displayed in that show.
Oh, really?
However, it's unfortunate. All that said, it's unfortunate that he is also linked to the hyper-diffusionist idea of Atlantis as the foundational human civilization that spawned all the others, including those of Mesoamerica. And, well, you know, it's like I always say, nobody's perfect, so... What you gonna do, man? What you gonna do?
Nobody's perfect, right? And just examining the life history of Dr. Ott was sort of illuminating to me, because I didn't really know a lot about the guy coming into this. Like I'd mentioned before, I heard of him briefly first in Rius's book on La Virgen de Guadalupe. And I heard of him briefly, or read about him briefly, in an old Mexica movement book where they had listed him as like great Mexican heroes. And so the more I poked into his history, I mean, the guy was, you know, complicated is an understatement. He had some complicated beliefs in the way that the trajectory of his belief system went through time. And I do this talk, and I released it as a premium episode for our listeners. But I give this talk on what I refer to as Hispano white nationalism, and I go into like this weird history of fascism in Mexico and how it has sort of permutated over time. And there was a group that I talk about, and maybe you already know about these guys, but they were called Los Dorados, right? The Gold Shirts. And these were men who fought in the Mexican Revolution. Like, they fought under Pancho Villa, and they had, you know, all these revolutionary ideals. But after the revolution, a lot of them, and I think it was the result of a combination of things. You know, a lot of these guys were very... hardcore conservative Catholics, and they had a lot of anti-Semitic views and anti-communist views. And so these men who had fought in the Mexican Revolution under Pancho Villa started like this very right-wing movement called the Dorados, the Gold Shirts. And it led to this, it sparked this interest in me, which prompted, you know, my putting the talk together. Was like, wow, how does that happen? You know, and sure enough, Dr. Ott kind of, you know, had this, he flirted with these ideas too for a while. Like he went down this road after the revolution, especially during World War II, right? Where he encouraged, Mexicans to side with the Axis powers. And it was for a combination of reasons, I think. And I found this paper. The name of the paper is Fascism and Sinarquismo, Popular Nationalisms Against the Mexican Revolution. It was written by Albert L. Michaels. It was published in the Journal of Church and State in 1966. So this might be the reason why I hadn't come across this information before. It was written kind of a while ago. But there's an interesting quote in here about Dr. Ott that I want to read. And it says, "The well-known artist, Gerardo Murillo, better known as Dr. Ott, became another convert to the fascist faith. Germany, he said, would defeat both England and France, a victory that would lead to a confrontation between Hitler and the United States. The United States, a weak pacifistic people devoted to pleasure, would then be defeated by Germany. Mexicans were urged to renounce the Havana Pact and assert their independence from the United States. Only by being on the winning side, he argued, could Mexicans avoid slavery in the future. Communism was associated with Judaism, and he blamed the Russian invasion of Finland on the ambitions of Israel." So here, again, we see this melding of being anti-Semitic and being anti-communist, birthing like this, you know, right-wing leanings in former revolutionaries and former Mexican revolutionaries. So I thought that was an interesting trajectory for Dr. Ott to follow.
It's really unfortunate to learn this about Dr. Ott.
Yeah.
He was someone who besides being a painter, a theorist, a philosopher, a politician, involved in the Mexican Revolution, all those things that he accomplished. You could even say that he was a foundational figure for the Mexicaoyot movement.
Yeah.
And ideas that he had. For instance, being against France might go back to his anti-Francophile leanings in the late 19th century.
Yeah,
When he was sort of responding to the positivist and the Eurocentrism that permeated a lot of the academy and the arts in Mexico, which is something that he was kind of going against. So that would make sense. It's unfortunate that this goes back to the old, a trope of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So in this case, the enemy of Mexico, and according to him, from his standpoint, it's France, it's also the United States, because, he emerged at a time when Porfirio Díaz was essentially letting foreigners, the United States, Germans, etc. Which is funny because he doesn't really, he's siding with the Germans on this one, even though Germans were part of also the Porfiriato's, league of foreign investors that were sacking Mexico at the time. Yeah. So it's interesting how he picks and chooses who he's going to side with and who he's going to be against. So you would think that Germany would be on the list. But so the people that would be on the list would be France, it would be the United States, and Finland. He's defending Finland because the Russians came in and they're communists. That's kind of strange, right?
And he even wrote a book that I found online, published in 1942. So like right in the thick of World War II, right? Called Los Judíos Sobre América.
Yikes.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound good. No, please don't say it so, Dr. Ott.
God damn it. Yeah. God damn it. It's always right.
Right.
God.
Right. That's been the case since the very beginning. It always leads to freaking Nazis for some damn reason with these folks.
Yeah. And, it's described as a study of the controlling influence Jews have in America and Mexico. God damn. And then the subtitle is, let's see if I don't butcher this, La Casa Blanca convertida en la Casa de Juda. ¿Y los Americanos? Question mark. So
the White House turns into the Jewish house.
Yeah.
And the Americans, what are they going to do about it, right?
What are the Americans going to do about it? Yeah. And so one other interesting thing that I found out about Dr. Ott while doing research for this episode that he was...
No more interesting things, please.
He was an ardent volcanologist, apparently.
Yeah.
And it was his love of volcanoes that apparently caused him, to lose interest in the right-wing fascistic stuff. Like he apparently, the story goes, he was one of the eyewitnesses to the birth of the volcano Piracutín in Michoacán. So witnessing this event was evidently so moving and inspiring that he left behind all of the political leanings that he was, flirting with at the time, and just became obsessed with volcanoes and started, was painting volcanoes and even wrote books, sound scientific books about volcanology. Which is that's a career, trajectory change in your career, so, if I've ever heard one, right there.
From politician, from artist to politician to thinker to writer on Atlantis to full-fledged volcanologist, apparently. Man, that's something.
Yeah, there's this article called The Artist as Volcano, written in 2005 by Jesse Lerner, and it kind of goes over this, and it says... of the many eyewitnesses to the birth of the volcano Piracutín, none was more enthusiastic than Dr. Ott. a man whose tireless activities as a landscape painter, political commentator, statesman, novelist, poet, chef, cultural promoter, polemicist, and utopian philosopher all take a back seat to his lifelong obsession with volcanoes. In the biography of Dr. Att, the eruption of Piracutin has another significance. It pulled the painter away from his pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic activities in Mexico, one of several extremist positions he embraced over the course of his life, diverting his attention from politics to volcanology. So thank you, Piracutin, for causing this.
So what I'm getting from this is that to get rid of Nazism, we have to throw him into the volcano?
That's what I'm getting here, man. Okay. That's, I think you read that correctly.
Yeah.
That's what I was getting. But this is a pretty interesting essay that this guy wrote, because he talks about, you know, these contradictions that Dr. Att had. And here's another quote from it that I really thought was interesting. It says, making sense of the multiple contradictions of Att's life is more challenging. How is it that the same author, and he's talking about the volcanology stuff, is responsible for the careful empiricism is of his volcanological texts and the considerably more speculative, not to say frivolous, writings like Un Grito en la Atlántida, which you had mentioned, which advances the thesis that the inhabitants of Atlantis spoke Nahuatl. God damn it. How does one reconcile his leadership role in the Red Battalions and the wobbly-influenced House of the International Worker during the Mexican Revolution, which is all like very left-leaning, pro-revolutionary stuff. I
mean, the wobblies.
With his rabid anti-communist and pro-Nazi writings from the Second World War. The answers are at best partial. At least part of Att's support for Hitler seems to be based in probably enough, and strangely enough, I might add, on their shared interest in painting.
Wow. So instead of workers, he replaced the workers with painters, and so it's Painters of the World Unite.
Painters of the World Unite, apparently. And Dr. Att wrote, this is a direct quote from Dr. Att, I have read in various English and French periodicals some writers mocking criticism of Hitler's background in art. So that's a weird thing to hone in on, right? It's like, yeah, the whole Jewish thing, wanting to take over the world. Yeah, hey, but don't criticize his art.
Yeah. I draw the line at his art.
Yeah. They know not of what they speak. The painter has, above other social types, the enormous superiority of his clear vision of things. Painters are the ones most qualified to govern and to create a society completely different from those that have previously existed.
Okay.
God damn it. That is an odd hill to die on right there.
It is.
Like, yeah, say what you want about the guy, but he was a painter, and I gotta go to bat for all the painters.
That's kind of strange, because I mean, if you look at his work and his paint, volcanic paintings and all this stuff, like, it's completely different from what Hitler was doing. Hitler was doing sort of mediocre classicist paintings, and that's why the Academy kind of rejected him, because they're like, "What is this?" I mean,
he was not a good painter.
Yeah, he was just, you know, copying the same style as before. You know, given the fact that you had already had all these trends that had innovated the art world for at least 50 years, you know, beginning with people like the suprematists, the constructivists, and the Russian, like Rodchenko and Malevich and those guys, even before cubism arises, even some of the theosophical people who were involved in that movement, like, they're credited with being the first ones to create abstract art, because they were painting things that were derived from their ideas called the thought form, right? And so they would try to translate what that thought was onto a painting, and you get these really surreal and very abstract paintings. And it is now acknowledged that those people that were doing that back in the late 1800s, even before the constructivists and those guys and the cubists, like they're the ones that initiated the modern abstract artistic movement. And so by the time you get to Hitler, these people are saying, like, what are you doing, man? Like this is so passe. Like, we're not looking for this anymore. And so Hitler was enamored with this idea of a former sort of a grandiose version of society.
Yeah, this former glory.
Former glory. And so you can see it in his paint, and you can see that, you know, after the fact, you know, hindsight is 20/20, but you can see that his art reflected his sociopolitical leanings. And so not that it's understandable that he went from painting to being Hitler, you know, a genocidal maniac, but
that's a verb, right? Now being Hitler.
But it makes sense. It really makes sense. And then to have Ott over here defending that, that's very strange. Very, very strange.
That is weird. But you know, one thing I've noticed in my life, though, especially amongst you know, the those in activist types, especially the ones that are artists and poets, because there's a lot of overlap there. Like the people, you know, activists who are artists and poets, is they're very susceptible to just wacky ideas. Like, you know, it's, you try to have a conversation with some of them and like they're just like, oh, I'm so deep. Like they try to just be so deep that they accept everything that sounds like it could be deep. And I've noticed a lot of the conspiracists that I've encountered in my life, a lot of them, I'm not going to say all of them, but a lot of them have some background as like artists and poets. Yeah, okay. So I don't know if there's some connection there. That's, it started with Dr. Ott.
DPDs. That's what those things are called, DPDs.
Yeah, you know, just, you know, well, you just don't understand things the way I understand things. A lot of that kind of stuff, you know, and it sounds like Dr. Ott was like, you just don't know, man. The painters, we got it figured out. You know, that's, we know what's up, bro. But you, in previous conversations, you know, when we were talking about Chicano muralism, like you traced, you know, because if Dr. Ott inspired Orozco and Siqueiros and Rivera and all of these famed Mexican muralists, who then in turn inspired the Chicano muralists. That's like a weird, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Genealogy.
Yeah.
I think is the word I'm looking for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's, it's interesting, to say the least, to pick that apart and be like, a lot of these ideas, or just the inspiration, not the ideas necessarily,
right,
but being inspired by someone's art and then finding out that the people who inspired their art was, you know, writing books like, you know, Jews over America.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like that old adage, right? Like, never meet your heroes or however that goes, because, you know, you have them put up on a pedestal and then you meet them and they can turn out to be complete jerks sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be the case here, Dr. Ott. Not that he's anyone's hero, at least not anyone that I know would say that they've ever heard of him, first of all, and consider him a hero. But the fact that he's sort of like, you could call him the godfather of Mexican / by extension Chicano muralism, because he's the one that sort of gets all that going back in the late 1800s. He was the first, I mean, he took those trips to Europe. He studied under some of the greats out there. Of their time, and he went to the Sistine Chapel and other places out in various parts of Europe, and he was, you know, in awe. He was inspired and he was enamored. And so even though he was against the Eurocentricity of Mexican art, he understood the value of taking the knowledge of the artistic movements from Europe and bringing those to Mexico, but using them in such a way to advance a more indigenous and more folkloric inspired movement that would give sort of an artistic voice to Mexican art, you know, so that Mexico could have its own artistic voice, its own artistic identity, and not just always completely sort of just looking towards Europe and copying and mimicking everything that Europeans did. You know, he wanted to enable and foster this idea of a native-born, indigenous artistic movement, even though you're still using the tried and true methods that were developed elsewhere in Europe, but you're kind of repackaging them in a way that is going to give Mexico its own artistic element, right? And so by extension, by the time you get to the Chicano movement, you know, a lot of those early Chicano artists that were inspired by the movimiento, and because they're artists, they weren't necessarily activists, they weren't necessarily politicians or academics, they felt like they could use their own artistic talents in such a way to be able to advance the ideals of the movimiento. And so they started looking. I mean, it's like going back to the episode that we did on the Day of the Dead, right? Like the reason why Dia de los Muertos is so huge now internationally and it has the flavor that it has. Of course, Mexico and the indigenous communities in southern Mexico get the credit for maintaining that, but the current iteration of it is something that is born out of Chicano artists that are looking back towards Mexico to try to find ways to reconnect and to be part and, you know, of the movimiento and bring some of that artistic element from Mexico and infuse it into the Chicano communities, which were devoid of their own artistic element, right? Before the Chicano movement, yeah, you had artists that were working, for instance, here in Dallas, we have Medellin, who was originally from San Luis, but, you know, he came to Texas at a very early age, and he ended up in Dallas, and he became a foundational artist here in Dallas, not just for the Chicano community, but in general for the artistic community of Dallas. And he's one of the most preeminent art institutes, named the Art Institute of Dallas, is something that he started. And he's known for that. And in fact, the Dallas Museum of Art just had a show of his, you know, retrospective of his work, a lot of it, which is inspired by the Mexican Revolution, by indigenous iconography. And also, he was a Catholic. He was uberly Catholic, and so he had a lot of Christian Catholic elements to his work, which is fine. But the point that I'm trying to make is that you did have people like him throughout the United States, but they were very far and few in between. And it's not until the Chicano movement that Chicano artists themselves, native-born in the U.S., right, that are saying, "What can we do to bring this voice, this element of art that our community needs?" And so who are they going to look at? They're going to look at, you know, the same thing that the post-revolutionary muralists were doing, Diego Rivera, Siqueiros, Clemente Orozco, with the grandiose paintings on the wall, right? To convey messages, right? The messages of the revolution or the post-revolution was this idea of creating a national identity. Because before the revolution, you had a lot of micro-identities, regional identities around the country. And so the revolution gives people that goal, something to look, you know, forward to, this national identity. And so they're doing that. They're conveying these political messages, these cultural messages. And if you look at a lot of the art, it's a lot of it has indigenous iconography. Most of it, you could even say, has indigenous iconography. And that's all because of what, you know, Dr. Ott started back in the late 1800s. And so going back to what you were saying about the genealogy of Chicano art, it goes all the way back to Dr. Ott.
And it's wild because that's something that we see a lot. We see it pop up a lot. It's a similar theme that pops up a lot in this podcast when we're examining where certain ideas come from, right? If you go back far enough to find out, well, this idea that we use was influenced by this, was influenced by this, was influenced by this. And when you finally get to the root, you know, sometimes it's a little disappointing what some of these people thought, right? And it's like, God damn it, why? You know, like I like, you know, I like the concept of, you know, you are the other me. Right. In fact, I even like the poem. I like the poem In Lac Etch. Luis Valdez, right? Wrote that poem. Great, great message. But then you go a step back and it's like, oh, Domingo Martinez Paredes. Okay. And then you go a step back and it's like La Plongeon.
La Plahu?
Yeah, and you start looking at these, like where these ideas were birthed. It's like, oh no, God damn it.
And then what was the name of that missionary? Was it a Dominican missionary or the one that came up with the, was it Hunabku?
Oh yeah, yeah. He wrote the Diccionario de Motul.
What was his name?
I'm blanking on his name.
Yeah.
But yeah, he invented the idea of Hunabku.
Hunabku.
Because they needed a word in Yucatec Maya that could roughly equate the idea of the Christian God.
Right.
Right. And so then you get these two concepts,
this Lakech and Hunabku,
and then with the art of the symbol that, you know, has its own story with the Argüelles. And now you've got people like with it tattooed on their bodies and with this totally distorted understanding of the origins. And that's why I think it's important that we do the work that we do, right? Like, you know, it's a bummer when we look back and we see something like, God damn it. So Dr. Ott, you know, wrote some like pro-Hitler shit? Fuck.
Yeah, that's, but I mean,
that's
I'm,
a bummer.
I'm not defending him. I'm not apologizing for Dr. Ott.
Yeah.
He recanted, you know, later in life. And, but I'm not sure if I already said this, but, you know, I think it has a lot to do with his anti-American sentiments, right? Anti-French sentiments that he had. And, you know, because he was also, I'm assuming he was probably a Catholic, and maybe he was an uber Catholic of the type that we see that tend to be, hold very problematic views. Let's just put it at that.
Yeah, that's putting
right?
it lightly.
And one of those problematic views that a lot of these really ultra right wing hardcore Catholics have is being anti-Jewish. Because why? Well, mm-hmm. because they're the ones that supposedly killed, you know, Christ, right? Even though, according to their own scripture, that was supposed to happen anyway. So it's
yeah.
like, get it right. Like, which one is it?
Anyway, well, when I was in Mexico, like the first time I was ever in the Zócalo, I was like taken back because I saw them selling copies of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Mein Kampf, like translated into Spanish. Both translated into Spanish were being sold on the street. It mixed in with all these history books and stuff like this.
You know what the solution to that is? You know how we can countervail that? We need to translate the Four Disagreements into Spanish.
Absolutely.
And smuggle that into Mexico, into the Zócalo, into the various tianguis, and tell them, hey, you know, here, get rid of that junk you got right there. No one's buying that crap anymore here.
Yeah, nobody believes that shit. So
push this.
Well, some people do. That's the problem. But I was stunned. And this was back when I was, I don't know how old I was. I was like 20, I think. Mm-hmm. And just being on the streets of Mexico and being like, why is this being sold here? This is fucking insane. But then the more I learn about Mexican history and like you were saying, the ultra-right Catholicism and stuff, I was like, okay, so it's all starting to make sense why this exists here. It's all these problematic views, these distorted ideas of history. You know, there's a reason why they exist. But, you know, like I said, I think that's why what makes what we do here so important is that we're willing to peel back that Band-Aid. And
yeah, even if it hurts when you peel it off.
Yep. Well,
you got to rip it off and you know, expose that wound and treat it right. Get some good medicine for that. And what's the medicine? What's the medicine that we use?
It's the truth, my friend.
The truth. That's right. The truth.
Because the truth, well, it's like medicine. It doesn't always taste good, but it is always good for you. Dimoitase.
Witcha!
Thank you for listening to Tales from Aztlantis, a project of the Chimali Institute of Mesoamerican Arts. If you enjoy the show, please consider becoming a Patreon supporter. You can do this by visiting talesfromaztlantis.com and clicking Support the Podcast. Your continued support will help keep the podcast ad-free and independent. Until next time, Dimo Itase.